In Buddhism, generally, compassion is important. And in Mahayana Buddhism, of which Pure Land is one type, of course, compassion is very highly valued. And yet, even amongst all of that, there's something the Jodo Shinshu tradition, which kind of takes this to the final degree, and constantly seeking to be inclusive, to embrace others as oneself and one's friends and one's family are themselves embraced, to recognize this embrace of the Dharma with everyone.
Hello, you're listening to Buddhist Studies Footnotes. I'm Cody Muncaster. I wrote the book Queer Engaged Buddhism, and I'm also a therapist at Pink Lotus Counseling and Psychotherapy. I'll be hosting a mini-series within this podcast. I'll be interviewing people about queerness in Buddhism and Buddhist studies. And today, I'm speaking with Dr. Jeff Wilson, who's an ordained minister in the Jodo Shinshu tradition and a professor of religious studies and East Asian studies at Renison University College, the University of Waterloo. So welcome, Jeff.
Thank you so much for having me, Cody. I really appreciate that. And I've appreciated the other episodes that you've done in this series beforehand. Very educational.
Thank you. Yeah, so thank you for being here. So just to start, I'd love to hear a little bit about your journey into Buddhism and what that's looked like and your work in the Jodo Shinshu tradition.
I would say that my journey begins when I became disillusioned with science. I'd been on a sort of science track through my younger years, high school into university. And then partway through university, I had a very sort of eye-opening experience at a lab where it turned out to be a very amoral culture, and people were not really asking questions of meaning or ethics in relationship to their work. And so I stopped sort of thinking, science and progress and technology will save us and bring in a better world. They won't do so unless we have sort of a firm sort of basis in ethics and values and appreciating people and the world and so on. That needs to be the starting point, and then that would guide science and things better. So I switched over into religious studies as a way of exploring these questions that were coming up for myself. And I happened to have a friend who was Buddhist from a Thai background at school, and she was lending me lots of books on Buddhism, and I found them quite interesting. So then I went to a Buddhist studies professor who was at the university, and he agreed to do a year of independent study in Buddhism with me, and so that exposed me to a wide range of stuff. And then I graduated and moved to New York City, where there were many, many Buddhists and many Buddhist communities. So I spent my free time going around and visiting with all of them and doing sort of amateur sort of field work in this way. And eventually decided upon the Jodo Shinshu tradition as the best one for me personally, as someone who had come into both a Buddhist studies and a Buddhist practice sort of dual track there. And eventually went to graduate school. That was a big surprise to me. That was after working at Tricycle Magazine, which is a big Buddhist magazine that was based there in New York. And eventually, many years later, surprisingly find myself as a professor teaching Buddhism, also as an ordained monk in the Jodo Shinshu tradition. Didn't know it was going to go here, but that's fine.
Well, that's quite the journey. And can you tell us a little bit about the Jodo Shinshu tradition for anybody who maybe isn't familiar, who might be listening?
Sure. So Jodo Shinshu is the largest form of Buddhism in Japan. It's a type of Pure Land Buddhism. Pure Land is by far the dominant type of Buddhism in Japan. It's also the largest form of Buddhism in East Asia, and arguably, depending on how you measure things, it's just the largest Buddhism that there is. It's also a very old tradition in North America and Hawaii, relatively speaking. And so it's, quite an important one. However, it doesn't necessarily get a lot of attention in certain English language forums. And so people don't tend to understand that Japanese Buddhism is primarily Pure Land. They think of it as primarily Zen, which is an important tradition as well, although it's very much a minority tradition, actually. It's especially among elites. So Jodo Shinshu, as a Pure Land form of Buddhism, is focused especially on the story of Amida Buddha from the Pure Land Sutra literature, on the idea that Amida Buddha has established vows that will inclusively bring people to the Pure Land. And through the Pure Land, this is a mechanism whereby all beings are able to be liberated from their suffering and sort of achieve that Mahayana Buddhist ideal. So therefore, Jodo Shinshu, like most Pure Land traditions, is focused especially not on things like silent meditation, that's a very elite, historically fairly rare practice, but rather on a much more accessible practice of chanting, such as chanting the name of Amida Buddha, say Namo Amida Butsu, putting your trust in the Buddha as the power of the Dharma, which is going to liberate yourself and others.
Thanks. That's a really beautiful description and really helpful for our listeners. And I'd love to hear a little bit about your academic work as well.
Sure. So I did my PhD at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where a lot of my work has been historically on looking at the transmission of Buddhism from Asia to the West, to North America, both Canada and the United States. That's really where a lot of my expertise lies. Also, of course, with Japanese Buddhism as well. So, therefore, I tended to think of myself as sort of doing trans-Pacific contemporary Buddhist studies. My first academic book was called "Mourning the Unborn Dead," and it looked at Japanese post-pregnancy loss rituals, is especially post-abortion, but sometimes maybe a miscarriage, a stillbirth. So, in Japan, abortion is not highly politicized, and instead, it's dealt with through Buddhist religious rituals, which acknowledge that harm has occurred and deal with the feelings of the parents, particularly of the mother, and try to sort of karmically deal with that situation and help people to come to terms with it and move on with their lives. So I was quite interested in how these practices then were brought to the United States and how they played out then in a different cultural situation. So that first monograph is looking at Buddhist abortion practices and how they're used by a variety of different Americans, whether they're Asian Americans or white Americans, whether they're pro-life, pro-choice, this sort of thing. So there you go. I rather thought that work was going to be behind me, but what do you know? It actually became quite relevant once again to be working on abortion matters in the United States. Then I did another monograph looking at regionalism within American Buddhism, sort of trying to deconstruct this idea that there's something called American Buddhism because there's very many sort of regional differences within the United States. I think we can all immediately recognize there's, for example, the South is a particular region, the West is a particular region, New England is a particular region, the Midwest. And Americans' experiences of living in these places are different. So naturally, of course, Buddhism itself differs across some of these regions. So I investigated that there and published an ethnography. I did a big book on examining the mindfulness movement. This was the first sort of major book-length sort of analysis of that movement or even industry we might think of it as, and how it became mainstreamed is what I looked at.
Yes, and I believe I saw recently that you released a book on Jodo Shinshu as well. Is that right?
That's true. So that's a Dharma book, not a Buddhist studies book. I do wear both hats. When I'm at the university, I operate in a certain mode and teach in a certain way. And I publish in that field and for that sort of audience and go to those conferences and act in a certain way. And then at other times, I also serve as a minister for the Toronto Buddhist Church and for the Hamilton Buddhist Temple. And I frequently go and speak at temples around Canada and the United States So, acting as sort of a Dharma speaker in this way, and I've published books that are in that sort of Dharma mode of exploring Buddhism, not as a cultural phenomenon from the outside, but my experiences and my thoughts about this or that Buddhist topic. So yeah, that most recent book is research informed, certainly, but is primarily sort of a source book for how Jodo Shinshu Buddhists who are interested in drawing on the kind of radical tendencies of Shindan, the founder of Jodo Shinshu, how they might draw on those tendencies to help deal with or think about the many sort of social issues that we faced in the sort of modern moment.
Yeah, and I know that book has a chapter on queerness, and I've also read, I think, two articles from you on queerness in Jodo Shinshu, one or two. Could you talk a little bit about your work in queerness in Jodo Shinshu?
Sure. I'm not sure precisely which articles you've read because there's been many of them, some in the academic mode, some in the Buddhist mode, if I can make that distinction. But they often frankly interweave with one another. So we shouldn't make too hard a line between them. I guess I would locate that if I were going to sort of narrate that as a story. Jodo Shinshu was the first Buddhist tradition in history to perform same-sex marriages. This is a practice which started over 50 years ago in Jodo Shinshu temples in the United States initially, and then spread from there. And I was aware of this because I was a community member. I've been a Jodo Shinshu Buddhist for many decades at this point, so I already knew about this. But then, basically, after I would say it was probably after in 2008, there was a big moment where various U.S. states were legalizing things. Of course, it was already legal in Canada at this point, but various states were moving in that direction. And in 2008, California, where the largest sort of number of Jodo Shinshu Buddhists live, they temporarily legalized things. The Supreme Court did so, and then in the fall, a state proposition came in and delegalized it temporarily. So, but there was this open window where people were rushing to go and get hitched. And people were performing lots of ceremonies, including the Jodo Shinshu Buddhists were performing many, many same-sex marriages at that time. And in fact, what was easily the most famous same-sex marriage in history up to that point was the marriage of George Takei from Star Trek. This was he was a, you know he was a celebrity. This was a major media event and so on. And of course, he comes from a Buddhist background. He actually started his acting, in Jodo Shinshu temple plays back in the day when he was a young person. And so he was married by a Jodo Shinshu minister in a Buddhist ceremony in Los Angeles to his now husband Brad. So that got major media play. And then I was thinking about this, afterwards, and I noticed how many Jodo Shinshu ministers were talking in their newsletters and other forums about advocating for same-sex marriage and saying, well, we've been doing this for many decades. The BCA Ministers Association had already put out an official statement in 2004 supporting same-sex marriage and opposing George Bush's re-election platform, which included keeping same-sex marriage illegal and so on. So I knew all these things, but it seemed to me that my colleagues didn't know about them. So on the one hand, people in Buddhist studies didn't know that this was going on over here in Jodo Shinshu. And then at the same time, Buddhist people, even activists outside of the Jodo Shinshu tradition, so Zen Buddhists, Tibetan Buddhists, and so on, really had no idea that there had been Buddhists already doing these ceremonies for like I say, many decades at that point. So I thought, well, there's a need to record this and put it onto the record so that people understand the history. So I did a lot of oral history work with ministers throughout the mainland US and in Hawaii. And this eventually led to an article in the Journal of Global Buddhism in 2012 that first publicized, first recorded these ceremonies and analyzed why it was that Jodo Shinshu had reached that milestone so much sooner than any other Buddhist group. So that was sort of the origins of that work, and I thought, okay, now I've done it, and that's good. And let me see, I'll go and do some other projects. But it didn't actually work out that way because as soon as that got out on the record, many people were very interested. So I was constantly being asked by Tricycle and Shambhala-san and other groups to write sort of popular versions of this sort of research. So for a wider audience, not for an academic audience. And meanwhile, the Jodo Shinshu temples themselves were quite intentionally going through a process of transforming themselves into much more overtly, consciously, intentionally LGBTQ plus welcoming and affirming organizations. So they were running an annual speaking series where they brought people together to talk about things. And so I was invited to the 2015 series to the seminar, which took place at the New York Buddhist Church, and in order to give some research on the history, sort of what I remember my talk was a queer history of Buddhism. So I was not just talking about same-sex marriage, but I was talking about larger things, including also same-sex marriage. And from there, I developed some trains of thought, which I can talk about, which go into all the way up into that book, the Queer Shindan chapter in my recent book. That was actually a great experience, I have to say, in 2015, because we had the seminar at the temple, and I was one speaker, and then we had various gay and trans and other Buddhists speaking and about their experiences and so on. And we had a good audience and so on. The editor of Tricycle was there in the audience, and then we get finished, and we hear that the Supreme Court of the United States has just legalized same-sex marriage at the federal level, right then. Like it was sort of this amazing sort of karmic confluence of things. And some of us, we went down to Stonewall and people were partying and everything. It was really ecstatic. And then the next day we marched in the Pride Parade as the temple. And it was just like such an incredible thing to be able to do at that very historic moment. So that was very cool. And then yeah, I've continued to work in that vein, often as a speaker at temples, talking about sort of my ideas about Shindan as a potentially a queer figure, and how Buddhism has acted as a queering force in Asian history at times, and just some of the various sort of lines of thought that came out of that initial seminar.
And I know you mentioned that you thought there might be something about Jodo Shinshu that caused it to be the first to do same-sex marriages. What do you think it is that caused Jodo Shinshu to be the first one?
Yeah, so I think it's a confluence of a number of different factors that all kind of came together fortuitously into a combination which led to people doing same-sex marriages, like I say, over 50 years ago at this point, and throughout that period. One thing is that Jodo Shinshu was founded 800 years ago as a non-celibate monastic order. So Shinran, like I said, was a real radical, and he pushed back at all sorts of practices and ideas of the sort of elite mainstream Buddhism of his time. He was seeking to make a far more accessible, truly lay-oriented form of Buddhism for the masses. He was himself a former monk who had then basically come down from the mountain and joined with the people, and eventually got defrocked by the government because of his threatening, socially threatening ideas about egalitarian Buddhist practice and so on. And so he was really trying to do a Buddhism for the masses, and he ended up marrying. So he became a married monk, and raised a family. And this actually even came from a certain vision that he had had of Avalokiteshvara, which had come to him and told him that because his karma was such that he would not be able to keep the precepts, that Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, who came to him in the form of a man, Prince Shotoku, who's a very important Japanese historical figure, said that he would transform into a woman and become his wife and have sex with him, and it'll be his supporter, and then help him go to the Pure Land at the end of his life. So, based on that sort of transcendent vision that he had, he set about sort of reorganizing a totally new approach to Buddhism that included the idea of married monks. So you have an 800-year lineage of non-celibate Buddhist clergy, and so that means that Jodo Shinshu ministers live lives that are much more similar to those of regular lay people, and yet at the same time they're definitely not regular lay people because they are professionally they're Buddhist monks and do all the rituals and they focus on Dharma and this sort of thing. So they exist in this neither this nor that status, but it is also a status that means that they're involved in marriage, they're involved in sexuality, they're involved in family raising and so on. And so they had been doing marriage ceremonies for a long time, and they had a I guess you would say relatively sex positive approach to Buddhism compared to other celibate monastic forms of Buddhism, right? So for them, the idea of same sex sexuality or same sex marriage, these are not inherently something that they thought about, but once they start to think about these things, as we start to get the gay liberation movement in the US and Canada and other places, it's not going to be that hard a journey intellectually for them to go from, well, we're already conducting many, many marriages and we're already involved in sexuality, and we already don't think that sexuality is something that in any way prevents you from following the Buddhist path. So they had a shorter distance to travel to get there, if I'm making sense, right? So that's one fact, that's a historical fact about Jodo Shinshu. Then another thing is that Jodo Shinshu was the majority religion of the Japanese immigrants to Hawaii and to the mainland, both in Canada and the US. That's because it was the largest religion in Japan, of course. So most Japanese Americans had a Jodo Shinshu background. And then what happened to them when they came here? Well, they experienced a lot of discrimination. I won't narrate all the things that happened in the many decades leading up to World War II, but there's lots of discrimination that they went through. And then during World War II, the Japanese mainland population, both in Canada and the US, they were all put into concentration camps. They lost their properties. They and their children were all forced into these camps. Two-thirds of them were actually Americans or Canadians by birth already at that point. But it didn't matter. They were seen as Japanese, and they were taken away in a process that we can maybe relate to these days as well. So coming out of that experience, there was a kind of a sort of a deep visceral disgust for prejudice and towards mistreating minority groups that was firmly established within sort of Japanese America, Japanese Canada, and with the Buddhists being such a large group, then they naturally thought in these ways. So once people started advocating for LGBTQ plus rights of various types, including marriage, once they kind of gave it a few minutes to think about it, they were not prepared to come out against another minority group's rights. They had been there was a minister who said, if I were to oppose this Japanese American Jodo Shinshu minister said, if I were to oppose gay marriage, then it would mean that I'm not acknowledging that just because the shoe is on the other foot, it kicks just as hard. So, like we've gone through it. Why would we put other people through of not having their legal rights and this sort of thing. So that's a unique historical aspect of that group, which made them more ready to support other people's rights. And then I would say that a very, very important part of this, and I hope I'm not going on too long because this is actually a key point, a really important point is that the central idea of Jodo Shinshu as a form of Buddhism is that Amida Buddha embraces all beings without any exceptions, and that Amida Buddha exists in order to liberate every being, every person from their suffering, and doesn't make any judgments about the people that are being liberated. So if the central sort of devotional dharmic source of Jodo Shinshu is embracing queer people and is embracing everyone, then Jodo Shinshu has no leg to stand on to try to like create an argument for not being supportive or for saying this group can do things, but that group can't do things, this sort of thing. Like there's fundamentally an inability to create a dharmically sound argument for discrimination. And instead, there's a fundamental argument there for inclusion. And so this is something that Jodo Shinshu ministers, once they became advocates, and they did become quite vocal advocates, both within their temples and also speaking to state legislatures and even signing on to Supreme Court cases and so on. They just keep coming back to this idea of Amida Buddha embraces all people, and therefore we too must follow that great compassion and embrace them as well. So in Buddhism, generally, compassion is important. And in Mahayana Buddhism, of which Pure Land is one type, of course, compassion is very highly valued. And yet, even amongst all of that, there's something the Jodo Shinshu tradition, which kind of takes this to the final degree and is constantly seeking to be inclusive, to embrace others as oneself and one's friends and one's family are themselves embraced, to recognize this embrace of the Dharma with everyone. So these are sort of the arguments that I saw Jodo Shinshu ministers using when they went out and tried to convince their congregations and convince the public at large that same-sex marriage was something that naturally should be supported and celebrated.
Thank you. That's some really important and interesting context, and I think that our listeners will really appreciate that. And I also know we've talked before, and you've mentioned that you're working on a book project right now, and I thought I'd see if you'd like to share a bit about that.
Sure. So it started out as a project looking at socially engaged Buddhism within Jodo Shinshu history in Canada and the United States, basically from the 1960s onwards, so about 60 years of history or so. This was kind of like a mirror version of what I had done before. I knew that there was all sorts of work that had been done, not only achieving same-sex marriage support, just literally generations before other Buddhists in the United States did, but also on all sorts of matters on abortion, on the environment, on many other things. I knew that there was all this work, and I also knew that when I went to read about engaged Buddhism or research about engaged Buddhism, which I do because that's within my field of expertise, I find that all of the works on engaged Buddhism never include Pure Land Buddhism. They just literally never include it at all, as if it doesn't exist, even though it's actually the largest form of Buddhism. And I knew that these Jodo Shinshu Buddhists had they created the first prison ministries, the first hospital chaplaincies, the first to do same-sex marriage, the first to publicly support abortion rights, you name it, they were there first. And yet they're just literally invisible to the mainstream narratives. So I thought, I guess there's a need to do a larger project that documents all of that sort of history. So I started writing a book in this way. And then I did that for the last 4 or 5 years, and I still wasn't done, and I looked at it, and it was already so long that it was longer than two book manuscripts put together. And the work on LGBTQ plus inclusion had itself become so large that it had turned into two separate chapters. And then each of those chapters was already twice as long as any academic book chapter has any right to be. And so I thought, okay, it turns out I'm not writing a book on socially engaged Jodo Shinshu history. I'm writing a book series. And so what I did was I then chopped it up. And so I took some material and I put it into one volume. I took the LGBTQ plus material and I put it all into its own volume because there was so much there that it was already the size of a decent monograph on its own. And then I took yet other material I put into a third thing. I won't talk too much about the other two volumes because what we're interested here in, I think, is this volume that I've written on Jodo Shinshu and LGBTQ plus history. And so this right now it's about 50,000 words. I still need to do the introduction and the conclusion. I do have the sort of five or six middle chapters all blocked out at this point, actually written. So it'll be around, be around 65,000 words maybe when I'm done. So it'll be a decent sized monograph. This is going to be certainly the first book link Buddhist studies work on LGBTQ plus sort of Buddhist history. And it'll be we've had occasional articles, though not nearly as much work as you would think. And we have a certain number of practitioner-oriented books. Though not all that many of those either, right? And we don't have anything that really charts the history of even a single tradition in any sort of substantive way. So this will be an important sort of pioneering book trying to do that. So I go back to look at sort of the pre-Stonewall era when Jodo Shinshu is in the United States and Canada is very heteronormative. I talk about what the situation was around gender at that time. And then I chart how that changes over the ensuing decades to the point where today Jodo Shinshu is sort of becoming recognized as the tradition that has done the most work and has achieved the highest level of sort of inclusion and affirmation sort of across a variety of different ways. In the United States and in Canada. So I'm telling that history sort of chapter by chapter. What were the factors that drove that? What were the obstacles? How were they overcome? What is the state of things now?
Yeah, and I wonder if you might be able to share off the top of your head some fun fact or interesting facts that you've learned or that you've included in the book from the history of Jodo Shinshu's engagement with queerness.
Some of the things I find interesting are milestones are often interesting to me, so I'll narrate that story of how same-sex marriage got started at the Buddhist Church of San Francisco in the early to mid-1970s. So not necessarily a coincidence that San Francisco is where Buddhist same-sex marriage is sort of born and then spreads throughout California and then elsewhere, right? So that's quite interesting. We have the creation of the first Buddhist PFLAG group. I'm not sure if all listeners will know what that is. That's Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. That was the original moniker. I do think that it evolved over time, but that was what it was called back in the 90s when you had the first PFLAG groups being started at Jodo Shinshu temples. Again, this is not going to be terribly surprising because there's a lot of really interesting Buddhist groups in North America and Hawaii. And a lot of the ones who get a lot of attention are groups that are basically sort of adult convert groups, people who leave whatever their religious tradition was and become Buddhist. They may become a Zen Buddhist or Tibetan Buddhist, or maybe the practice Vipassana or something like this, right? But Jodo Shinshu is a family Buddhism. So naturally, they would be the first ones to start PFLAG groups because they're raising kids, some of whom turn out to be queer. So the Buddhist temples are forming groups for parents to be able to talk about that and learn to support their kids family and so on. So that's a nice milestone. There's a lot of support for people during the AIDS crisis in the 1980s, which I spend an entire chapter looking at there. That was something very important. I'm at this point getting to be older, so I lived through all of that. It was a really dark, terrible time. So it was very interesting to revisit that and see what the Buddhists were doing and the ways in which they were supporting. They helped to establish the first Buddhist AIDS hospice in the San Francisco Bay Area and so on. They financially supported it so it could get off the ground and so on. Yeah, lots of great stories in there. And maybe one of my favorites though would be so in Japanese Buddhist tradition, they have a midsummer major sort of festival or observance called Obon. And this involves folk dancing, which is very important, and lots of games and Dharma services and so on. It's a Buddhist-based summer festival. Just recently, the very first queer Obon was held in Los Angeles, where Jodo Shinshu ministers helped to organize this Obon, and they had, like I say, you're doing folk dances, and so you have you usually have one or a few sort of people. It's usually women in sort of very beautiful kimonos who act as models. They're showing the moves, and you're trying to copy them, this sort of thing. And so they had one of the contestants from RuPaul's Drag Race. She was she's also a Jodo Shinshu Buddhist, and so she was the person there helping to model the dances and everything. And there was just this sort of joyous outpouring of people who weren't certain whether they were would be accepted at Obons and in other situations, or people who might be hesitant to dance and express their queerness at Obon because maybe they're not necessarily out to their family or maybe to their whole community. So they here is a place where they could come, they could be fully engaged in their traditional culture, and they could be fully visibly, publicly expressing themselves in whatever their queerness may be. It was a really joyous sort of event, and I really quite like that story. Also, I've got great pictures and so on from that. So those are just some of the things in there. Like I say, it's a whole book, so I could go on, but I'll stop there.
Wow, I'm incredibly excited to read it. Do you have an idea as to when it might come out?
I don't. I'm still working on it. Ironically, I was just negotiating with a publisher today, academic publisher, and so I'll probably bring it there, but we don't have a contract signed yet, so I won't mention any names. I imagine this might be 1 to 2 years away. The real problem is I'm just terribly busy. Otherwise, I have to teach full time. I have to help with the temples and their services. I'm a parent. I have children. I'm quite actively involved in that. And so the writing proceeds more slowly than one might wish. Also, I just keep finding new great stuff. And so, like I said, it used to be one book. Now it's three books. So the longer I write, the more I keep finding. So the longer I keep writing. So, at some point I'll have to have an editor who tells me, okay, that's enough.
Well, it's such an exciting project. And you mentioned that the book also discusses the current situation for queerness and Jodo Shinshu. What would you like to share with our listeners about the current, just the current situation for queer people in that sect of, in that tradition of Buddhism?
Sure. So, one should be cautious about making generalizations because, I'm the person who published on regionalism and how people's local experiences may not be the same as other people's local experiences and so on. So, I'll talk broadly, but with the caveat that any given person's experience might not be represented, or any some community might be further behind on this sort of timeline generally that I'm going to lay out. But generally speaking, The Jodo Shinshu temples in the United States have really transformed themselves quite intentionally, and we're also working in the Canadian temples where I'm doing a lot of work to help them as well. So there've been there's basically lots and lots of workshops and conference sessions and so on held at temples. Which have been going on quite actively for over 15 years at this point. Lots of internal publication and discussion about LGBTQ plus matters, about the need to be inclusive, about how to actually go about and do that. So at this point, after that process of transformation, which is an ongoing journey, I want to stress, we have both the mainland American organization and the Hawaiian organization, which are institutionally separate, but they're both otherwise the same type of Buddhism. They're just bureaucratically different because Hawaii wasn't a state for a long time, and Buddhism actually started there before it started on the mainland. They have both many years since published official supports for same-sex marriage, for LGBTQ plus inclusion, and so on. They've all held many workshops about inclusion of queer people, including trans people. We have prominent queer, including trans ministers serving temples, or also as lay leaders who are well known. The rising class of upcoming ministers. Just in the last few years, because they study as a cohort, they were actually majority queer. So things are really changing in the sort of clergy population. And I would say that generally speaking, there's a lot of ongoing interest in going further. Many temples participate in pride, for example, whatever their local pride may be. That includes here in Canada. The Toronto Buddhist Church has been going to Pride the last couple of years. This year will be our third year marching, and we're not the only Canadian Jodo Shinshu temple doing it, but we were the first Canadian temple to get out there and do so. There's been occasional Buddhist participation in prides previously, but never Buddhist temples. So this is a new sort of institutional development. So I would say that things are quite good. There's a European scholar who B. Scherer, who works on various topics within Buddhism, including queer and especially trans Buddhist perspectives. And they have described Jodo Shinshu as the most sort of LGBTQ plus inclusive form of Buddhism. And I don't think that was always true, but I do believe that that's now just a objectively true statement at this time. And that's because of the work that many people have done in order to bring about transformation. There's also LGBTQ plus affinity groups that meet at various sanghas, Jodo Shinshu sanghas, and they put out materials both for that population and also for the wider temples, coming to understand better the queer people within their midst and how to serve them, and why this is dharmically what people should be pursuing. So, it's always going to be an imperfect situation. We are in samsara. We are not in the Pure Land, and we will never be perfect in any way, but there's been really heartening work done to achieve a really substantial level of inclusion and affirmation and celebration within the Jodo Shinshu temples now.
Oh, that's really incredible. And I just had one last question, building on what we just talked about. I wonder what your thoughts are on what other Buddhist traditions could learn from Jodo Shinshu in terms of improving their inclusion of queer and trans people.
Well, I guess there's a variety of ways we could approach that. One is practical matters. There are specific steps that any sangha could take, any congregation, Buddhist or otherwise, could take in order to assess whether their congregation is sort of is queer inclusive, queer affirming, and is a comfortable and safe space for everyone. So there's specific actions that one could take, and this is based on my training by Reverend Brent Hawkes, who runs the Rainbow Faith and Freedom organization based there in Toronto. He's the retired minister of the Toronto Metropolitan Community Church and an important figure in establishing same-sex marriage rights in Canada. And he gave us some training at the temple, which we've then taken on board and sort of Buddhicized to make it more locally relevant. And then I've been sort of delivering workshops based on this sort of thing in various temples. So he has this acronym, SPACE, SPACE, and it stands for checking things such as your statements. Does your congregation, Buddhist or otherwise, have official statements that they are seeking to be inclusive and that people are to be included and to be respected? And also looking at things like policies. There's the P there. Are there things within the congregation's policies that are discriminatory? And if so, can you go through processes to change them and so on? I won't go through the whole acronym, but there's specific procedures that people could take or that congregations could take. And so we have been doing some of this work within the Jodo Shinshu temples, and that is something that any other Buddhist group could also just as easily do, right? So that's something that's open to anyone. And then there's a lot of things that are particular to the Jodo Shinshu tradition. Like we have a just inherently stronger emphasis on lay practice, on absolute universal liberation and total inclusion of all people. So that's something that's distinctive. But those ideas of valuing both the lay people and the monastics, of seeking to be compassionate and of hoping for the liberation of others, those as ideas exist across Buddhism and are not unique to Jodo Shinshu, even though they're sort of uniquely stressed and played out within that tradition. So those are ideals that any Buddhist group could choose to lean into and try to develop, sort of mine that vein of compassion there in order to transform their views or transform their Sangha practices. And then one more thing I would say is that, Jodo Shinshu is 800 years old. It's a mainstream form of Buddhism in Japan. It's got over, what is it? It's a over 120 years here in Canada and longer still in the United States. So very well established. Other Buddhist groups could just look at that and say, okay, this is a regular Buddhist group. This is not some new religious movement or something that just got formed in the last, few decades, as we've been sort of undergoing social change or anything. This is a historic mainstream Buddhism. And if they are able to transform themselves through compassionate intentionality, well, surely that means that other Buddhist groups could also choose to walk that path. They may their own path may be a little different because there's many different forms of the Dharma, right? But ultimately, the Buddha is supporting our efforts to try to bring freedom to everyone. And I think that that's something that any Buddhist group could take the inspiration that, hey, there's some people who did it. Can't we do it as well? Like we've proven that the paradigm can be achieved.
Wonderful. It's such incredible work, and it's very inspiring to hear about the history, the present, and some things that other groups can do as well. So we'll close there. Thank you so much for your willingness to do this podcast. We really, really appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, it's very much my pleasure, and I look forward to further episodes in your series. That's great work. Thank you for doing that. There's a lot that we can all learn.